right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and it's right in the middle of the holidays, so this is going to be a hell of a show anyway, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Thomas Alan Harris. Thomas is the director of a new film called Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People. And this film is currently, you can see it in theaters around the country in different cities, but it's also going to be airing on February 16th on PBS, so you'll be able to catch that then. And maybe we'll be able to rerun this when it happens, but definitely check this interview out today because it's all about the dehumanization of black people throughout history and the fight against that. And it's all captured up in a very beautiful film about the role of photography in the emergence of a people. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to bring this segment to you. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking with Sue Montgomery. Now, Sue is a Canadian journalist who covers justice issues in courts for the Montreal Gazette, and she is also one of the co-founders of the hashtag Been Raped, Never Reported, which has just struck a chord among millions and millions of women and many men who have responded to the hashtag, telling their story and offering support for the fight against the dehumanization of women through rape and sexual assault. And just before we welcome Sue to the show, let me tell you a little bit more background about the whole story. Last October, a Canadian radio host named Gian Gomeshi was fired from his job after numerous reports that he had sexually, physically, and emotionally attacked and abused women. In late October, the hashtag Been Raped, Never Reported was launched and went viral, bringing forward millions of women to speak about their own experience as victims of similar abuse and assaults. The hashtag was launched by two Canadian women, Antonia Zerbisius, an award-winning Canadian journalist, and Sue Montgomery, a Canadian journalist who covers justice issues and the courts for the Montreal Gazette. Joining us to talk about all this today is Sue Montgomery. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's jump into this. It was really just mind-blowing to read about what happened in the wake of your establishing this hashtag. But let's start off with people understanding, what's the story of how and why the hashtag was created?
Well, on the last Sunday in October, I was on Twitter and I saw that Gian Gomeshi had been fired. And I had listened to his show on a daily basis. I mean, he was an amazing interviewer. I always, you know, I loved his show. So I saw that he had been fired and I thought, okay, that's odd. I mean, our public broadcaster wouldn't fire someone for no reason. And then he came out with this Facebook rant or explanation or apology or whatever, saying that this was a jilted lover and, you know, the CBC had learned he had been into S&M and bondage and, you know, they had no right to go into his private life. So he really launched this offensive, you know, he got out ahead of the story. And I read this Facebook thing and I thought, the words jilted lover kind of set me off. I thought, I don't really believe this. And then within the next hour or two, the Toronto Star, which is the biggest newspaper in Canada, came out with a story about how all these women, or three women they had accused him of sexual assault. So I basically was online watching his career melt down, like in real time. And then, so Monday, Tuesday, and then there was all Wednesday, was all the reaction online about, and people were screaming, you know, because they love Gian Gomeshi. I mean, he's a big radio star. So people were jumping to his defense and saying, why don't these women come out and give their names? Why don't they go to the police if they have solid allegations? And I was getting increasingly angry about this reaction because I knew why these women weren't coming out and giving their names, and I knew why they weren't going to the police because none of us do. So I wrote to Antonia, who lives in Toronto. I live in Montreal. We're about 5-hour drive between us. And I've never met her in person. We've only chatted on social media, but she's a social media addict, I would say. So I said, listen, what if we start a list of all the women who've been raped and never reported it? And I'll go first. And she said, okay, how do you want to do it? Twitter, Facebook? And I said, I don't know. I don't care. I just want to do it. She said, okay, what about this? Hashtag been raped, never reported. I said, fine. We both like threw out our stories in 140 characters and it just took off, like literally like a wildfire out of control around the world. what was interesting is neither one of us knew that the other had been raped. We had never had that experience. Like so many women in the world, you keep it quiet. You don't talk to each other about these things. It's not, you know, common conversation. So that was kind of a revelation, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about that, just following up on that, you talk about that in what you've written about it as a silent, shamed majority that exists in the country. 80% of women who are assaulted and raped never report it. Let's talk about that a little.
I think the majority that we're talking about, there are two kinds of sexual assault in my mind. One is the minority where you have the stereotypical stranger who breaks into your house and rapes you and takes off, and then inevitably the cops catch him because of the wonders of DNA, and the society is outraged and they want his head, you know, and he ends up going to jail. And then the majority, well, in our country, it's about 86%, are the assaults that happen by someone that you know. So let's say it's a family member, someone you're married to, someone you date, someone you have a drink with, an employer, a colleague. So what happens is, you know, this happens to you and you second guess yourself because you think, okay, what did I do to cause this? You know, I must have led him on. I mean, this is the way we're raised all the time, right? Like, don't go out of the house and that skirt's a bit short, and make sure you don't drink too much and don't walk alone at night. And everything is put, the onus is put on women, and it's always like, well, it must have been the way she was dressed or something. So that's the first thing, that we blame ourselves. And then the second thing is, it's very, very hard to admit that someone you work with or you party with or that you're married to or you go out with, someone you perhaps love or like or respect, could hurt you in such a profound way. So we tend to say to ourselves, okay, maybe it didn't really happen, because to admit that it happened is really, really painful. So I think that's why there is this silence. And also because the few people who have come forward are not believed. So it's like you're a snail and you come out of your shell and you dare to tell somebody and they say, oh, come on, like that would never happen. So you just retreat back into your shell because it's just too painful.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sue Montgomery. Sue's a reporter who covers justice issues in courts for the Montreal Gazette. And in late October, along with another journalist, Antonia Zerbesius, she started the hashtag Been Raped, Never Reported, and millions of women around the world responded and are continuing to respond. Now, Sue, one of the things, as you're talking, I was thinking about this. There's another aspect of this as well. And when I was reading all about what you folks have done and what you wrote. And I was thinking, you know, here's the thing here. There's a lot in common with what we see in this country, for instance, of a lot of when black and brown youth are killed by the police here. They kill the person first, and then they kill them a second time by destroying their reputation and implying that they were somehow deserved to be shot, that they were doing something, as you're saying, doing something wrong, or that this is just what these people are like. And you get the same sense that that's very much the case when women report it and are immediately suspected of she really wanted it, you know? It's kind of...
Well, exactly, that we ask for it. And then what I find interesting about this movement is that the women that are speaking out, like in Canada, we have politicians speaking out about their rapes, like from years back, and things that happened to them while serving in government or working in universities or whatever. So we are, the people speaking out now are white, largely educated, professional women. So if we have a hard time coming out and telling people what happened to us, can you imagine if you are a marginalized, a woman of color, a Aboriginal woman, a single mom, drug addict, homeless, all those marks that are against you in society, nobody's going to believe you. So why would you come out? And the sad thing is like many times, these marginalized groups are even more of a target because they are so vulnerable. You know, they're just trying to survive. We have a problem here in Canada, dozens, maybe hundreds of Aboriginal women who have gone missing over the years. And, you know, there's very little public outcry about it. And I think that if the same phenomenon had happened, let's say, with white professional men or even white women, there would be a huge outcry. There would be like, what is going on here? But because it's a marginalized group, a group that tends to have a high level of alcoholism or prostitution, people write it off as, okay, they're not really worth it. And if they were working as prostitutes, they probably were asking for it. So what this movement has done is sort of equalized everybody. Like the marginalized women have found the strength to also speak out now because there's strength in these numbers. This phenomenon crosses all socioeconomic lines. It has happened from the richest to the poorest to the most well-known to the least well-known. I mean, you have your own scandal in the States right now with Bill Cosby. You know, you see these women coming forward and accusing him. So I think that when that happens, when the ice is broken, it gives other women the confidence to say, to see that they're not alone and they can also speak out.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the thing is, I was just going to talk to you about Bill Cosby, too, because, well, actually, Bill Cosby and also Ray Rice, the football player, mm-hmm. who earlier was, you know, I mean, the video showing how he savagely beat his wife and dragged her out of the elevator. And then, you know, it was sort of like, well, you know, this is his personal business at first. They weren't going to do anything about it, or they just gave him a slap on the wrist. And with Cosby, there's still that thing about, wait a minute, this is Cliff Huxtable. He's America's father, you know? Come on, he's the best dad in the world. Would he really do this stuff? And that's the undertone that's out there when all these women are actually reporting, look, this is what he did. He basically gave me drugs, and he raped me, and he did this, and he did that. And there's still, even in the reporting that they do on it, there's still that sort of that hint of, do you really believe this?
I think Gomeshi was the same way, Jean Gomeshi here. And any of these men who have this kind of power and this star, that they're stars in their community, they're untouchable. And that filters down right into the family where the father, the grandfather, the uncle can get away with it because they're fine, upstanding citizens and good family men. Like, he would never do something like abuse a child or rape a woman. Our society just doesn't want to believe this. And so I think we're at a point now where we need to look at what is going on here. Like, what is it about men, and in some cases women, who get this kind of power and stardom that they abuse it in a way that they can take advantage of people who are vulnerable, who are under their spell, sort of thing? What is it about human beings that makes them do that? Like, that's what fascinates me. And then the very fact that they are so powerful is what protects them, because nobody is going to believe an underling over the star of the show. And in many cases, your marks depend on this person, your career depends on this person, your marriage, your reputation. It's a huge risk to come out and accuse somebody of this, because chances are they're society will believe him over you. Mm-hmm. So the odds are stacked against us. But I feel, this has been going on for 3 weeks, this hashtag. And as you know, in our society, the news changes daily, or if not hourly. So this story has sustained itself for 3 weeks already, and it just continues to grow. I mean, the hashtag has been translated into French, into Spanish, I don't know how many other languages. It's reached as far as South Africa, Colombia, Iran, Ukraine, all over Europe. So I feel that the earth is shifting, you know? And the other thing is, you know how the internet can be a very nasty place? The trolls have been silent. I have not received one negative comment or response or anything from this hashtag. And that was my biggest fear when I hit send, was that I would be brutally attacked. And there's been nothing.
Wow.
Which is shocking.
Yeah, definitely. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Sue Montgomery, a journalist who covers justice issues and courts for the Montreal Gazette. And in late October, Sue was one of the journalists who launched the hashtag Been Raped, Never Reported, and millions of women around the world responded and are continuing to respond. And Sue, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking, God, it must have just blown you away, one, to get just that deluge of responses, but also in reading through some of the things, that stories are so damn moving, and there's such a commonality in them that, one, I mean, you point out that in Canada, there's 500,000 sexual assaults a year, and that 86% of the victims are women, with 60% of those women being under 17. And, you know, in the U.S., it's probably 10 times that to a certain extent. And that wouldn't be strange, given the way this society is. But there's a whole point here of, like, what people found in that hashtag, in that movement, what they found and what they were able to tell. I mean, it was overwhelming for me to read them. How did you respond to that when you saw it?
Well, to be honest, I haven't even had a chance to really read through the tweets because, well, first of all, I work full-time covering the courts. I'm covering a very big murder trial right now. Luca Magnotta is this guy that killed a lover, an escort, a client, and dismembered him and mailed his body parts across the country. So it's a huge story. Like, it's very odd for that to happen in Canada. So I'm covering that full time. Plus, then this happened, and it's just taken off like crazy. But I'm actually buoyed by it. Like, a lot of people think, oh, it's so depressing to know that it's so widespread. I knew that it was that widespread. I knew that. I mean, I've traveled to many, many countries. I've talked to women. I talk about this a lot. That doesn't surprise me. But what I find encouraging is that all these women have found their voice, and men, I have to point out. I've received a number of private messages from people who aren't ready to go public, which is fine. You know, you don't have to go on Twitter. You don't have to go on Facebook. You do what you feel comfortable doing. But I've received private messages from people saying, I was abused as a child and I never told anyone, but now I'm going to go to the police. What do I do? People asking me for my advice on how do they report these things. People telling me their stories privately because they didn't want to go, they weren't ready to go public with it. So I'm encouraged by it because just the fact of telling someone. Like, I tell people, if you just go into a room and say it out loud, that's the first step. Like, that is incredibly liberating just to do that, to get it out. And then you take the next step where you tell a friend, and then you tell a couple of friends. I think there's this huge relief happening around the world. I'm encouraged by that because I'm convinced that many of the problems we have in the world right now with mental health and crime and violence, so much of it stems from abuse, sexual abuse, as children and as adults, and these secrets that we hold. Before I became a journalist, I worked as a prison guard in a women's prison, and every woman I talked to in that prison had been sexually abused. And I'm sure there was a correlation between the abuse and ending up in a life of crime and prostitution, and because you don't value yourself. I mean, I happen to be one of the lucky ones that went the other direction, but the majority end up destroying their lives because they just don't feel worthy. They feel, you know, dirty, destroyed, used, just like not a worthy human being. So I really think that this is sort of the key of changing society in terms of treating our mental health problems and all the other things that go with that.
Leading into the last question I have for you, and it's more a comment that I'm really moved by. When I read the accounts and I saw the numbers, and my assistant producer was telling me, you know, this is a story we have to do, we have to do. And I was looking at the situation, and at first I was like, okay, you know, it's a story, it's important, but is it something we have to do now? And as I read the things, and even talking with you now, I kept thinking, okay, there's something that's concentrated here. And what you were talking about, it's definitely true. But I think also it concentrates, like when you were saying, why does this keep happening to women the same way and all this stuff? You know, it really does concentrate sort of the whole way that this society, and for me, I believe it's the whole ethos of capitalism, and, you know, not just capitalism, but from the beginning of class society, there's been women from the very beginning of class society, women have been relegated to a secondary bottom position in the hierarchy of the society. And it's mm-hmm. gotten particularly grotesque now, the distortions, mm-hmm. the horror of it all. And to see that sort of commonality concentrated, that concentrated oppression in the responses to your hashtag, to sending that out, to see that concentrated in there, and then to see also really exactly what you're saying, the collective breath of relief mm-hmm. and liberatory.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, like, what I've noticed, I've had many conversations on social media, too, with men who I consider to be progressive, intelligent, feminist. They had no clue that, never mind sexual assault, but we are flashed on a daily basis. We are masturbated in front of on a daily basis. They had no clue to what extent this happens. I don't know if you saw that video about the woman walking through New York and how she was catcalled. Anyway, there's this video that's going around social media. And, you know, it just shows, like, that, how you're hassled walking down the street. Now, if that happened to men, would they put up with it? I mean, you know, what is it about men that they think they can do this and treat us? And my feeling is they just don't get it. So we need to have this conversation. We need to have a very frank and honest and open and respectful conversation where we say, you know what, when you say that to me, it really bothers me. And we need to give women tools to deal with that. Because if you're at a party and some guy is coming on to you in a really aggressive way, you don't want to be the one to put a damper on the party. So how do you deal with that? We need to role play and to show women, you know, this is the way you can get out of that situation without being labeled like Debbie Downer at the party or whatever, you know?
The other thing I think we really need to actually pay attention to, too, is that actually, look, you know what? We have to be very clear. And everyone who has any idea of what's going on has to be very clear. Women are not property. They're not sex toys. They're not beasts of burden. They are full human beings and need to be treated as such. And that demand for human dignity, the accordance of human dignity to everyone, especially to women, has to be insisted upon by everybody.
Yeah, it's true. But it's one thing to say that. Like, you go into workplaces now, they have a poster on the nice poster on the wall talking about their sexual harassment policy. But does anyone read that? Does anybody even know what that is? Like, that's just following regulations. Bring the staff into a staff room, do some role playing, saying this kind of behavior is not acceptable. When you do this, this is going to be the consequences. We need to educate people about what it is. What is consent? Why is it wrong to grab someone's ass? You know, like, I just don't think that we get this. And I think we have to start teaching that at a very young age, like in kindergarten. You know, we need to start in school. We need sex education. It should be compulsory in every school all the way up. And teach parents how to talk to their kids as well. I mean, the bottom line is everybody's embarrassed by this. Everybody's uncomfortable with it, but it's a daily fact of life. Like it's as common as eating your lunch or, you know, sleeping at night. This is part of our daily life, is interacting with each other. So we need to learn how to do it because we're really bad at it.
All right, Sue, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. But thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sue Montgomery. Sue is a journalist who covers justice issues and courts for the Montreal Gazette. In late October, Sue, along with another journalist, Antonia Zerbesius, started the hashtag #BeenRapedNeverReported, and millions of women around the world responded and are continuing to respond. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was the Budos Band with Trail of Tears. When I was at Sundance earlier this year, I saw a film that was just incredible. I didn't know what to expect when I went into it. I watched it and I was floored. I was really knocked back. It was a beautiful, beautiful film, a very moving film and a very powerful film in terms of the what it revealed about the, well, something that's an ongoing subject to this show, the intense dehumanization and attacks and assault on Black people in every aspect of their lives, including actually basically their lives themselves. And the film is called Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People. And the director is Thomas Allen Harris. And Thomas is joining us today to talk about this. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into this. Let's talk about the title insofar as it concentrates what the film's about.
Well, the title has actually two parts. One is more descriptive on one level, you know, Black photographers. The film is about the ways in which African-American photographers and African-American communities have used the camera as a tool for social change from the invention of the medium in 1840 approximately to the present day. And so that's one part. And Through a Lens Darkly, in some ways, references the memoir aspect of the film, which is my personal journey through this material and also through my own family archive and my own family, you know, kind of psyche. And not only when I say my family, I'm talking about both my nuclear family and extended family, but also the family of my country, you know, my America and also the humanity. And so the film actually has these interweaving kinds of trajectories.
I want to ask you a question about one person in particular so I don't forget this and wander off somewhere in the middle of the interview or leave it to the end. Deborah Willis figured largely in this film and in your desire to actually make this film, right?
The film actually started when Deborah Willis approached me about making a filmic interpretation of her book, Reflections in Black, Black Photographers from 1840 to the Present. And it's a groundbreaking publication. It catalogs the contributions of African Americans to the field of photography. And it's an amazing book, going decade by decade with amazing scholarship and scholarly essays. One is by Robin Kelly, who is also interviewed in the film. And when Deborah first started working as a photographer, or studying photography rather, she was amazed and dismayed, as she says in the film, by the lack of inclusion of Black photographers in the history of American photography books. And so you know, that actually got her started on this life mission to make a corrective and to find these images.
Now, when you started on the film, you actually, and this amazed me, you actually went through 20,000 or more photos in the course of making this film?
Yeah, well, you know, we were building off the work of Deborah Willis. She had an amazing base to start with. And then we were looking to make a narrative out of this great book. And we were trying to figure out, well, how do we make a movie, you know, out of this amazing encyclopedic tome of African-American photography and the scholarship. And one of the things we realized is that we needed to include the landscape against which African-Americans were operating, particularly African-American photographers and people who were going to the photographic studio to get their pictures taken. And that landscape was filled with stereotypes. So the ways in which, you know, the two types of representation is one person, one vote, but there's also how one is represented within popular culture, as Ed Guerrero talked about, and that can define the limits of one's life. And so if you're represented as human in popular culture, then it's difficult to not treat you humanely. If you're represented as something other than human, as African Americans were, both in terms of, you know, before the end of slavery, in terms of legally, three-fifths a person, you know, in terms of how they counted politically, but also representationally, they were represented, or we were represented, as something other than human or less than human. And so there had to be a kind of a correlating suppression of any images that refuted this. And those were images that talked about our contributions to this country, that talked about our historical significance in this country, that talked about our humanity, that talked about us as family members, as citizens. And so all those images were suppressed. And they were suppressed in such a major way that a history of photography book that came out in the 70s, as Deborah Willis talks about, did not have any contributions of African-American photographers, even though there were hundreds of African-American photographers taking pictures of African-American families making their way out of slavery, making their way through Reconstruction, through Jim Crow, and, you know, and beyond to the present day. So by the suppression of these images and of the works of African-American photographers, we also have this suppression of the evolution of African-American families and what that looks like. So as a filmmaker, you know, where I see it most prevalently and perniciously is the images that come out of Hollywood. You know, most people really refer to, even African-Americans, we're invested in a certain stereotype, and we don't have the vocabulary or even the grammar to be able to articulate Black humanity in this country.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Thomas Allen Harris, the director of the film Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People.
You know, and that's actually the way you cast this too, which is very important, I think, in the back and forth all the way through the film. You talk about this, everything you've been talking about, as a war of images and a battle between self-affirmation and negation, which I thought was extremely sharp in terms of all the rest of the stuff that you go on to present in the film.
Yeah, you know, I think that another artist in the film, Hank Willis Thomas, talks about why it's easy for African-American young men to shoot, you know, African-American young men over, like, petty things. Lyle Ashton Harris also talks about this kind of black-on-black violence, whether it's against someone who looks like you or against oneself. And it's because we also, you know, are subjected to this kind of this void of affirmation of our humanity and this ever-present kind of distortion. And, you know, this is going beyond positive versus negative images, but it's just like, well, how do I see myself as having value in this country, in this culture? And, you know, and I talked about Hollywood, but it's also advertising, you know, and television and the kinds of stories that we tell to one another. And so it's really, it is this war of images, and it's an ongoing war.
Yeah.
But when one looks at what African-American photographers, and particularly African-American leaders, and how they were strategic in terms of their position, in terms of positioning the image with regards to the Black press, with regards to large expositions that happened in at the turn of the century, that both Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois were part of, with regards to the way in which the NAACP pressured Hollywood in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, you know, 50s, and fought against the Birth of a Nation. The people were very much aware of this issue of representation, and then you have it circulating again in the wake of the shooting of Michael Brown and, you know, and Trayvon Martin, and you know, people affirming, or not so much affirming, people talking about this issue of visual literacy and representation. You know, for instance, If They Gun Me Down, that campaign that emerged on Twitter and on Facebook. You know, if they gun me down, would they use the image of me, you know, like holding my baby, or image of me, you know, taking my kid to school, or image of me as a son, or, you know, or a daughter, or, you know, or graduating from high school or college? Or would they use the image of me when I'm out partying at the end of an evening of partying, when I'm like, you know, kind of dazed and confused, you know, and which could more easily be constructed as this kind of criminal? So I think that, you know, even though young people don't necessarily have access to all the history that the film talks about and engages, there is this awareness that, you know, representationally, we are constantly being manipulated, and a need to kind of reframe things, and reframe our image, and to acknowledge what's happening, even though mainstream does not necessarily understand or empathize with with the situation.
We're talking with Thomas Alan Harris, the director of the film Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People.
Well, let me ask you about a few of the photos that really struck me, or the stories that really struck me. And a couple of them you began to hint at, but I want to go in a certain order here, because the daguerreotypes and the ones that were of particularly of the enslaved people, that was so powerful to me. And I remember, I think maybe at the Q&A at the showing at Sundance, there was a point made about that the way that the people are portrayed there showed a whole different aspect, basically a whole different portrayal of a people who were defiant and proud and holding on to their humanity. And it was shown through the enslaved people simply staring into the camera, which was something that was never allowed or done before.
Yeah, you know, that's the Slade daguerreotype series that, you know, Carrie Mae Weems' work really brought to the fore. You know, she discovered this archive at Harvard and actually reappropriated it, made us understand and see it in new ways that could be liberatory as opposed to just a kind of like an image of a slave, you know? And I think that that's what's really interesting about this new kind of scholarship. And it informs also the way in which we approach the film, the narrative approach to the film. I was very much aware that there's a generation of artists and scholars who are shifting our relationship to history, particularly around, you know, how we understand things, you know, and that we can't necessarily see things at face value, that we actually, looking at the same image, we can, you know, just a subtle shift, we can understand something that's new and different about it, even in a photograph that of a degraded state, quote unquote, of someone who is enslaved. One of the scholars actually talked about looking at this image and the power of this woman who is, you know, in bondage. This is the first time she's able to look up and look directly in the face of the person, and the white person is taking her, or the, you know, the master class is taking her picture. And that act in and of itself, we look at that as opposed to look at exclusively the fact that her clothes have been taken down from her shoulders and a bunch around her waist, you know, making her exposed, but look at the fire in her eyes. And so we can kind of see this and also understand the kind of framing of the photographer and his perspective, and to actually name it, which Carrie Mae Weems does with her work. You know, you become an anthropological study and critique the framing of this woman in this photograph, which in some ways we're blessed to have, because it's some of the few images, number one, from the time of slavery, and to, you know, try to understand what that was like, what that experience was like. And we've never had a kind of truth and reconciliation around that particular institution called slavery in this country, and how we are the inheritors of that system, and how it shapes so much of this country in a way that's not about casting blame, but how do we reconcile ourselves to this reality, the history and the reality?
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Thomas Alan Harris, the director of the film Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People.
You know, there's so little time and so much to talk about. I don't know where to go, but I'm thinking about this. You know, some of the very powerful things that you bring out in the film are that whole series of lynching photos and the social uproar around that, in terms of the really reactionary, racist, you know, way that this was all played out. And that was incredible. And it reminded me of Dylan's song where he talks about they're selling postcards of the hanging, you know, and it's just you're seeing this and you're thinking the dehumanization of people just was carried out to the extreme. And you counter that with then the rise, particularly after the famous photo of Emmett Till in his casket, and then you have Gordon Parks and you have Roy D. Carava, and the actual assertion of humanity, of Black people's humanity in the face of all this. Very powerful stuff there, man.
Yeah, you know, it's we tried to, with every single image, because I'm in the film and I, you know, talk about what's at risk for me as an African-American male in this country, artist, male, you know, family member, citizen, and actually go through my own family album, you know, I'm able to really kind of take a poetic kind of perspective on this not poetic in the sense of rhyme, but poetic in the sense of, kind of like an ode to the family album, and the images that are in there, the images that are missing, the images that are present, and the images that were very present at one time that are missing now, and also kind of re-envisioning them. So I think that with the lynching image, we normally look at the body and look at the torture. And so I really wanted to actually decenter this, because when we do that, we're like, repulsed by the whole act, and it is a repulsive act, but what's going on in those images? Why were there so many, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of these images? Why were they circulated so widely? Why are family members inscribing their names on the backs of these images, from aunt so-and-so, this is what we did to the 16-year-old boy, And what does that say about the human condition and about who we are as Americans? And why are these images now collectible, in a certain way that's different than it was back then? And how are these images also surfacing in family albums across the country? And what must that be like to have, to go into a box in an attic and find an image from an ancestor, who happened to have witnessed, this and participated, because the photographers participated. And then it also talks about the missing, missing people in my family, my grandmother's father. What happened to him? What happened to him and what happened to his brother? Why are they missing? Why did my grandmother refuse to tell me stories about his death or recount, what happened? And when I was growing up, my grandmother, had photographs of her father and her grandfather, and I would ask questions. It's very difficult to get to talk. And I do know that she actually had a scar on her neck when she was 2 years old, when her father's funeral occurred and when he died. And, so she was crying, and somehow a pin got stuck in her. So she swallowed a pin, a hairpin or something, and she had to have this kind of surgery. And but this issue of, well, what happened to them, and why can't we find out what happened to them? And we do know that he was, a dark-skinned man married to a woman who was African-American, but who also happened to be blonde and blue-eyed because her father was white. And so, this, I think that, this trying to understand, what this country is built on, and also how we've emerged, and how we're emerging, and what it means to take a picture today for, let's say, a young person to have a sense that when we take a photograph, we're creating an archive, and what does that mean? So I think that we are in a time of the archive because so many pictures are being taken, and we've been with photographs for the 180 plus years, and Frederick Douglass was actually writing about photography at the beginning when the technology emerged, and he said, it's democratized this issue of representation, because heretofore, prior to this, only people of royalty or very wealthy people could have a likeness of themselves made, with a portrait, that was it took a lot of time to do, and also money, financial investment. Whereas with this new technology, a servant girl, she could have enough money to take a picture in the studio, could have her likeness made and preserved.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with film director Thomas Alan Harris about his movie, Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People.
Now, I have two more questions, and one is I just want to hit real quick, and I really do appreciate what you're talking about, the importance of family albums all through the course of the film, because they do really actually help to fill out the whole picture there. But I wanted to also ask you this, the impact of the 1960s on the photography of Black people and on Black photographers, what was that like?
Well, Deb Willis would be the perfect person to talk about that, because she's, written so much about that, and again, this film builds on the work, the scholarship she's done in terms of photography, but in the film, she talks about the ways in which, because of the civil rights movement, things shifted with regards to the press. Before the 1960s, a lot of Black folks, Black photographers and image makers were making their living from work with the black press. And then in the 60s, you know, you had the civil rights movement shifted a lot of things, and then also the riot. Well, and so the mainstream all of a sudden realized that they needed to have coverage of what was going on in a more diverse way, you know, and so black photographers were hired, and it opened things up. You know, you had a black photographer being awarded the Pulitzer Prize. You had the black press also still being robust and covering the uprising from the, for instance, the murder of Dr. King from a particular point of view and what was going on in African-American communities. You had black photographers covering the Black Panthers in a way that was much more empathetic than the mainstream press, which was constructing that as kind of, you know, terrorists, and was not looking at all the kind of community support they were providing in terms of their school lunch program and breakfast program for kids and educational programs that were happening in these communities that were really bereft of their resources because they had, you know, politically been marginalized. And so after that, you also had the Black Arts Movement and kind of celebration of what we look like as our Africans themselves, you know, in terms of the African standards of beauty as opposed to a kind of European model. And so, you know, the emergence of the Afro and, you know, kind of celebration of a range of skin types that could be considered to be beautiful and photographed and could be in magazines, black and white, because, you know, some of the black press, you know, also privilege lighter skin and European beauty, modalities of beauty. So that, you know, things were shifting in that way. And then out of that, you know, the, you know, contemporary black artists who were able to step into spaces that the Black Arts Movement opened up with regards to mainstream institutions. And we have a lot of contemporary artists in the film, you know, whether you're talking about Carrie Mae Weem or Lorna Simpson or Dawood Bey, you know, who are working in a much grander scale internationally and are redefining the landscape for the next generation.
Now, one of the things I want to ask you about, as I kept looking at this, and there's the point that your film sort of winds up on in a certain sense, but that it really comes through the whole thing, is the question of how to keep one's humanity in an inhumane world. And you tell the story about your cousin Peggy and what happened with her and that point about her having to come to grips with how she was viewed in the world, but then also how she viewed herself. And I keep going back and forth between that and then related to that, I wanted you to also talk about a little bit Yo Mama Pieta, because I think that has a lot to do with the whole question of the humanization of black people and black youth and the dehumanization today and what gets allowed under those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, the Pieta is an image by Renee Cox, of the artist Renee Cox. It's an image of her tableau staging where she staged herself as a kind of Pieta holding the fallen man. And, you know, it looks like a reference to, you know, whether it's to Jesus or to Isis and Osiris, or, you know, it's this myth of the Jesus figure actually goes way back. And so I don't want to just have it stop at Christianity, even though it, through a lens darkly, does quote the Corinthians, and I forgot to mention that earlier, Corinthians, where there's a kind of discussion of how do you see God? You know, and the response is you can see God through a lens or through a mirror or through a glass darkly, talking about the idea that we are all aspects of the divinity. And to be able to see that within oneself is what we can achieve now. And at some point in the future, you might be able to see, you know, be united with the divine. But that's in the future. Now, what we can do is, you know, to be able to acknowledge the reflection as an aspect of divinity. In terms of the Peggy picture, Peggy's my cousin and several photographers, and one of the photographers, John Pinderhughes, photographed her, I think it was in the 90s, and he captured her at a moment when she had found, you know, had just been told or, you know, accosted by someone who said, you're pretty for a dark girl. You know, and that, you know, how does one respond to that? It's like a backhanded slap, you know. And you know, she's also been photographed by my brother, Lyle Ashton Harris, who's the, you know, amazing photographer and installation performance artist. And his work what's missing within the Black Family album, you know, because there's certain images they're missing or certain stories they're missing within the African-American Family album, and that's the LGBT, you know, people who are parts of our family. And so his work actually really inserts that narrative into the family as something with pride, you know, so that people, you know, who are LGBT and African-American don't feel like, you know, they're left out of the equation, that they don't matter. And, you know, there's a high suicide rate, you know, among LGBT folks, particularly African-American LGBT folks. And so so it's not simply, you know, the American Family album marginalizing Black folks. Who, as African-Americans, who do we marginalize? And how can we affirm our humanity and give the blessing to those who are a little bit more vulnerable, you know, in terms of power and access to power? And so I think that that's really important. When we were doing, we did a project, we're doing actually a project called Digital Diaspora Family Reunion. It's actually a touring roadshow that goes with the film. And we invite people to come and share their family photographic albums with us, you know, live performative base. We blow them up to the size of cinema, and we have a VJ and music, and people are encouraged to tell their stories and show their family photographs. And it's amazing the kinds of images and stories that come out of the Black Family Archive. Images going way, way back to the 70s, 1870s and beyond. And also, you know, images, stories of people who happen to be LGBT members of their families that, you know, that come out. Stories of people who have passed, and for which maybe there's an image, and maybe, you know, before they pass, and maybe there's not. You know, there's all these different stories, and they fill in some of who we are and say something about our condition. This idea of looking at the family album, especially now that the family album is becoming, the curated family album is becoming a kind of a thing of the past, you know, in terms of the books that we inherit, that people have still spent time labeling and putting them in order, you know, that's actually migrating now to libraries. And as we enter the digital age, what are we doing with our archives, and how are we preserving and also creating who we are? Mm-hmm. And is it just the fragility of it being in the cloud or being on a phone or, you know, or being on, you know, Facebook or whatever? How do we use this tool to affirm ourselves and others?
All right, Thomas Allen Harris, thank you very much for your film, Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People, and for talking with us today.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate you giving us the time, and I hope everyone could come out and see the film, Through a Lens Darkly. It's also going to be broadcast on the Independent Lens series on PBS on February 16th.
Oh, great. Tremendous. Well, we will definitely pump that one up too, man. All right,
and
Thomas.
The last thing I just want to say is people can see more elements of the film on our website, oneworldonefamily.me.
All right, Thomas. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Take care now. As we move to the close of yet another show, there's something I wanted to bring to you in relation to both segments of today's show. And it's a quote that actually talks about the dehumanization and the objectification and the oppression of women. But I think it has a lot to do with, similarly, with the situation facing Black people. And I wanted to read this, and it's taken from Bob Avakian's book, Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. And Avakian's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. So check this out. Look at all these beautiful children who are female in the world. And in addition to all the other outrages which I have referred to in terms of children throughout the slums and shanty towns of the third world, in addition to all the horrors that will be heaped on them, the actual living in garbage and human waste in the hundreds of millions as their fate laid out before them, yes, even before they are born, there is on top of this, for those children who are born female, the horror of everything that this will bring simply because they are female in a world of male domination. And this is true not only in the third world. In modern countries like the U.S. as well, the statistics barely capture it. The millions who will be raped, the millions more who will be routinely demeaned, deceived, degraded, and all too often brutalized by those who are supposed to be their most intimate lovers. The way in which so many women will be shamed, hounded, and harassed if they seek to exercise reproductive rights through abortion or even birth control. The many who will be forced into prostitution and pornography, and all those who, if they do not have that particular fate,
And even if they achieve some success in this new world, where supposedly there are no barriers for women, will be surrounded on every side and insulted at every moment by a society and a culture which degrades women on the streets, in the schools and workplaces, in the home, on a daily basis, and in countless ways. Once again, that's from the book Basics, from the talks and writings of Bob Avakian. And you can access Basics. Actually, you can get an ebook of Basics at the site revcom.us. And I really encourage people to go to that site, revcom.us, because that's where you can find out a lot more about Bob Avakian, his work, as well as find out a lot more about the movement for revolution and all of its expressions. All right. Once again, that's revcom.us. I want to thank all of my guests for today. Sue Montgomery, the Canadian journalist who co-founded the hashtag Been Raped, Never Reported. I also want to thank Thomas Allen Harris, the director of the film Through a Lens Darkly, Black Photographers and the Emergence of a People. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Once again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do that on Facebook and Twitter. And it really does help if we can gather up a whole lot of people to follow us. It helps to spread the news of the show and to spread the movement. All right, we're going to go out now with a song that is appropriate for the season and appropriate for my own feelings about the world today, all right, and about us. And it's Tom Waits doing his version of Somewhere.
Time to spare. Time.